Good afternoon. This is Greg Lois. I have exactly 12 o'clock Eastern time. So thanks for joining us today. Today we are going to be talking about wage replacement benefits in New York. So thanks for joining me today. This is going to be a lot of fun. I see that we have people still popping in. So welcome aboard for our presentation today. This is a completely live presentation. And I am going to be taking questions, so please feel free to type as this presentation unfolds. Ask me questions, I can see them pop up. It's always my intention to answer as many questions as possible. I'll try to answer them at the end, and I will never embarrass you. So I will not say your full name, I'll just say your first name. I will read your question so everyone in the audience knows that I am answering it, and then I will do my best to answer your questions. So please ask questions. It does make this so much more fun. Now, we've got an interesting topic today because we are going to be talking about wage replacement. Money drives this system. And so we've got to talk about how do we challenge that entitlement to money to get traction in our cases. In order to do that, I've got to do an overview of wage replacement and medical benefits. I have to talk a little bit about maximum medical improvement because that's that inflection point where the person turns from getting wage replacement to getting a permanent residual disability or compensation for an impairment. I'm going to talk about when we can stop paying wage replacement. Is it because I'm a mean person and I just like to stop paying people things? No, it's because that's how you can get traction in your case. You can bring the other side to the table to try to resolve their case. I'm going to talk a little bit about labor market attachment in this presentation, and I'm going to, of course, focus on are my pet peeve, which is tentative rates. And in this jurisdiction, tentative rates, I believe, are not a good practice. They do not put the employer in a good position, and there are rare, rare exceptions to that. So this topic of challenging indemnity benefits fits into our overall litigation model. And you know, we look at cases and we say, hey, what's my best method of obtaining leverage in this case? Or how am I teeing up this case for resolution, for closure? Nobody wants a workers' compensation case. These things are not like a fine wine that get better. You don't want to have these things kicking around. So when a new case comes in, our initial thought pattern is, how do I close this? What are going to be my best closure path? Indemnity benefits, we think about raising contradictory facts and testimony, and generally speaking, the litigation of this. So challenging the entitlement to ongoing monetary payments, usually obtaining contradictory independent medical evaluations, and using that money disruption to posture the case to settle. Our focus here at Lois Law Firm is on tactical actions. What can we do in a case to get some movement? Of course, we keep our client informed of what's happening, and as we get traction in the matter, we're going to keep revisiting that closure plan, because the truth of it is these things are not like chess games. You know, you're setting these grand strategies, and really the strategy in our comp case is let's close it. Really, we should be focusing on tactical action. What are the small things that we can do to push this case forward to get some leverage towards resolution? Our job here, our job as your attorneys, is to spend most of our time executing and helping recommend small tactical actions that we can help you with to push that case forward to case closure. And applying that to today's topic, which is wage replacement or money benefits, our tactical action is to reduce or suspend payments if possible to provoke some type of response. And hopefully we are getting a response from our adversary and they're saying, hey, let's stop the pain. Let's go and settle or resolve this case. Hopefully they'll get a good outcome that we can report to you. And again, keep trying to get this case into an action loop so that we can try to move the matter to closure. Again, everything I'm going to be talking about today is going to be about the tactical actions in our cases, the way we use the law and the facts in order to move them forward. All right, let's zoom back into today's topic, which are, what are the benefits for the employee under the workers' compensation system? Well, the first benefit is medical treatment, and as we talked about last month, the claimant has an absolute entitlement to all necessary and curative medical care. Wage replacement or indemnity benefits usually follow the medical treatment. And once the claimant has reached maximum medical improvement, there are permanent disability benefits as well for the residuals of permanent impairment. This jurisdiction also allows for death and dependency benefits. So when you're thinking about the sequencing of benefits, typically medical benefits occur first, wage replacements happen during that initial period where the claimant is recovering from the residuals of their injury. But once they reach maximum medical improvement, or once they're past curative and palliative care, once they've reached that medical plateau in which they are no longer restoring more function, or their condition is not susceptible to a cure, well, now they've reached maximum medical improvement, and that's when wage replacement ends. Now, a lot of you listening are like, well, that's great, Greg, but I've never really seen a treating physician in New York who says the claimant's reached maximum medical improvement. And the reason for that is it's a little bit of a unicorn, and it's very hard to get a treating physician, once they've got their hooks into a claimant, to say they've reached maximum medical improvement. So oftentimes we are using independent medical experts to get that type of opinion moving and getting the case going, grab some traction. But that's when wage replacement ends. It ends at maximum medical improvement, and then the claimant might be eligible for permanent residual disability benefits, right? We're going to compensate them for their permanent impairment. Now, the claimant is always entitled to both curative and palliative care, always, and it's limited in the accepted matter by the medical treatment guidelines, which again, we talked about last month. Once treatment is no longer curative, we're ready to push for a finding that maximum medical improvement has been reached. And a claimant can have reached maximum medical improvement and still be going for some ongoing care. What kind of care am I talking about? Well, I'm talking about things like physical therapy or some chiropractic, stuff that maybe maintains their level of function or allows them to feel a little bit better or restores mobility or motion, but it's not going to be curative, right? It's something that makes them feel better. And that can continue after they've reached maximum medical improvement. Once the claimant's at maximum medical improvement, you really should be attempting to close your matter by way of arguing that they have a permanent residual disability if there is any continuing impairment, and try to close the case out that way. Now, some concepts that we just need to be aware of: the claimant cannot be both temporarily and permanently disabled at the same time. And there are situations where the claimant can seesaw back and forth between temporary disability and permanent disability, right? Because they can have gone through a course of care, reached maximum medical improvement, both sides get permanency evaluations conducted, there is residual impairment, and then the claimant gets compensated for that permanent impairment. But then a year later, maybe they need a surgery, right? Maybe they need to undergo new curative care. When that happens, they can transition back to receiving temporary disability benefits. Again, that temporary disability benefit and permanent residual disability benefit cannot happen at the same time. You're either temporarily disabled or you're permanently disabled. You can't be both at the same time. This presentation is about wage replacement benefits. We are going to cover in a few months permanent residual disability benefits. And the way to think about some of this too, and the way I think about cases, is whether or not the argument that I'm raising, is it tactical or strategic? Tactical issues that I'm raising in a case, or challenges that I'm making in a case, give us some leverage or provide us some momentum or a moment to bring the parties to the table. So when I think about challenging something like medical treatment, that's typically a tactical challenge in the case. It brings the other side into the case. They have to deal with the fact that we are challenging either bringing in a new body part or challenging the necessity of treatment. But you're generally speaking not going to close or win the case when you're disputing a medical treatment issue. And the same thing with indemnity benefits or wage replacement benefits. Generally, a challenge on these benefits should be considered tactical. Because remember, you can win and have the benefit be suspended for a specific reason, but then the claimant can go and find a new doctor or bring in a new body part or start treatment over, and then be again re-entitled to indemnity benefits. So that's a common issue. So when you raise one of these issues or you challenge the entitlement to wage replacement, just know that can often be a short-term win or a tactical win, which means, by the way, when you have a tactical win or you get some short-term momentum, that's your opportunity. We should be talking about resolving or closing the entire case. You've brought the other side in, you've challenged their entitlement to ongoing benefits, maybe for a short period of time, That's your moment. We should be moving, and we should be moving hard. Challenging things like permanent residual disability and the nature and extent of permanent disability and whether there is any disability at all, that's a strategic argument, right? Because if you prevail and you prove there is no permanent total disability or permanent partial disability or scheduled loss of use, any of those concepts, good news, your case is closed, right? It's over. You probably prevailed by way of judgment. So that's how I think about these issues that I'm raising in the case. And by the way, that's how I think about everything in workers' compensation. Like, it's great to, you know, memorize the rule book, and I got one right here, right? And know all the case law and the statutes. But really, the point of knowing that stuff is so that you can raise the issue or raise the challenge, get all the parties together, and have that momentum, have that moment. And that's what we focus on here. It's really kind of sad if you think about your job as a defense litigator, as your job being, I'm just here to like litigate these cases. Like, no, my job is actually to create opportunities for my client to resolve these matters. My clients did not go into business because they wanted to have workers' comp claims or have litigation over them. They really want to move on with their lives, either get the claimant back to work and let's keep moving, or let's close out this case in another way, perhaps by way of a Section 32 lump sum dismissal. So my job and the way I look at the law and the way I apply the statutes in the case law is, how can I create an opportunity for my client using this? Okay, that's always my outlook. All right, let's dive into this topic, and I hope I've teed it up enough and I've whetted your interest. I see we have a lot of attendees today, and I'm just going to do another pitch. Please ask questions. Please, it's great to get questions. It makes this so much more interactive. You're here live listening to me. I'm talking to you live. So let's use this opportunity to have a discussion about this topic. All right, let's move into wage replacement. So what are these benefits? Well, we've hurt somebody at work. They got injured at work. I'm assuming that this is an accepted matter. You know, we don't have fault defenses in the workers' compensation context. But by the same token, we're not exposed to any claims that the claimant could make for example, pain and suffering or loss of consortium, and obviously there's no juries. The worker gets a limited wage replacement benefit at the time of their workplace injury. And this is called an indemnity benefit, and it's paid on top of and in addition to that medical benefit that we talked about last month. Now, wage replacement benefits in this jurisdiction have a maximum, and that maximum is 2/3 of the average weekly wage that the injured employee earned for the entire previous year. There are statutory maximums and minimums, which I'll talk about in the upcoming slide, but we also talked about this in the January presentation. We talked about, hey, what are they entitled to? And the answer is 2/3 of their average weekly wage. That's the wage replacement benefits. We also talked about the fact that there is a waiting period in New York, and that waiting period is 7 days until benefits are issued, and we don't go and fill in that first missing 7 days of benefits until 15 days has elapsed. So they have to have 14 days out of work for us to go back and fill in that first week that was paid. It's a fairly simple calculation to determine how much money to pay the claimant for their wage replacement benefit. You simply take 2/3, multiply it times their average weekly wage, and multiply that by their degree of disability. So if an injured worker is earning $600 a week and was totally disabled, they get 2/3 of $600, which, check my math, should come out to be $400 a week. And if they were partially disabled, less than totally disabled, they had a 50% partial disability and they were unable to work and we could not offer them light duty work, they would be entitled to half of that benefit, so $200 per week. So again, relatively simple to calculate, and I don't really get many questions anymore about calculating wage replacement. Now, there are some issues that you're going to confront in wage replacement, and that's where typically the employee has worked less than a full year. So as we talked about in our presentation in January, there are other methods of calculating the average weekly wage. So you can refer back to that presentation or take a look at the handout, which has a very lengthy description of how this works. Other times or other complications could be where the employee is under 25 years old. And so there might be a potential for them to calculate a wage expectancy. Other issues, how about where they have concurrent employments? And they're losing time from all of those employments. So we talked in January about similar workers and how disabled the claimant is, all those types of things. And that all comes out to, how do I calculate that average weekly wage. So that's just something for us to be mindful about. Now, I think we need to attack on out-of-control temporary disability benefits, okay? And in fact, I think this is one of our best and strongest areas to attack on. So when I talk about attacking on this, I mean, we can use this as a tactic to create leverage in our case so that we can start to push this case towards resolution. And the reason for that is, in my opinion, most workers' compensation cases are being fueled and are the purpose of them is to acquire money. There is a secondary gain or monetary consideration, particularly in cases that have dragged on for more than 6 months, and the claimant has turned this into their new retirement program. Using or attacking temporary disability is one way to get the claimant amenable to settlement. And in certain scenarios, by raising issues surrounding wage replacement benefits, we can actually force the claimant to go out and do some work, actively pursue their claim. And as I'll show you in upcoming slides, the burden is not that significant, but it's enough where most cases settle once we raise this issue. Now, I think you must attack on out-of-control temporary disability. And that's because the claimant has a high degree of control over this in New York. They control their lost time by selecting physicians who are going to find that they have a total disability or a partial disability and that it goes on forever. They're going to control lost time by delaying necessary treatment. We talked about this last month when we talked about how they can schedule their own treatments. And because they only have to go to the doctor once every 90 days, lo and behold, they schedule their appointments 90 days apart. And they will do that also for treatment and testing. You know, they go to a physician, the physician says, all right, you're going to need an MRI. They don't go and schedule that MRI 2 days later. They go and schedule it 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 4 weeks later. Well, what's happened in the meantime? While you're waiting for them to get that necessary test, you're paying them wage replacement. And by doing this, they are dragging out the length of time in their case. The claimant in this jurisdiction only has to show medical evidence of disability every 90 days. Their attorneys are instructing them, hey, your job now is to go to the doctor every couple months. And you can see patterns emerge in our cases. And I'm defending hundreds of them. And I can tell you, I see this pattern all the time. If this person really did have a significant injury and need for care, they would be going to the doctor much more frequently than once every 90 days. Also in this jurisdiction, there's an incentive built into dragging out the amount of time that the claimant is out of work, because extended periods of temporary total disability will actually increase their scheduled loss of use award, because New York has a concept called protracted healing period, which will actually add on additional weeks of benefits to a scheduled loss of use award. So that's really something that, this is why we focus on this, and this is why you can see, I don't know if you can tell at home how animated I'm getting about this topic, because this is one of those areas of law where we can really be getting taken advantage of. And I hate that when my clients get taken advantage of. So let's talk about two scenarios. I'm going to talk about scenario one, in which the claimant is allegedly totally disabled, I should say. And scenario two, where they are partially disabled, so they're less than totally disabled. And these are really should be thought of in your mind. Like when you're drawing the mental map of how you defend cases, you should be thinking these are like two separate sort of litigation paths you're on. Where the claimant is totally disabled, we have one set of options. Where the claimant has a less than total disability or is partially disabled, we have a completely secondary, a completely different set of options. In fact, we have many more options. So let me walk you through that. Let's look at scenario one first, where the claimant is temporarily totally disabled. Okay, so again, the claimant's doctor is saying consistently they have a 100% disability. Their doctor is saying that they cannot work and they cannot earn wages, but again, this is temporary. Now, the word temporary is insane in this jurisdiction, by the way, because under the New York law and case law, you could be temporarily disabled forever. Like 1,000 years, you could be temporarily disabled. And those of you who practice in other jurisdictions are going to be like, what? That doesn't make any sense, because many jurisdictions have a limit on how long you can be temporarily disabled. So, for example, in New Jersey, which, by the way, Lois Law Firm has an amazing New Jersey defense practice, New Jersey has a hard limit. It says you can only be temporarily disabled for 400 weeks. Now, if you do the math, you go, wow, that's almost 8 years. That's still a really long time to be temporarily disabled. But New York has no such limitation. A claimant can be temporarily disabled for the rest of their life. And when you think about the amount of money that's moving, the average weekly wage can be quite high. The amount they can get per week, right now, the maximum is $1,145.43. That's tax-free money for the rest of your life, and all you have to do is go to the doctor once every 90 days. That's a great deal. That's better than any defined benefit program that I've seen. And so you could see that there's an incentive because the word temporary doesn't really mean anything in this jurisdiction. You could be temporary forever. During this period of temporary total disability, they are entitled to the full allowable wage benefit, which we've already discussed is two-thirds of their average weekly wage. Relatively simple to calculate it and relatively clear to determine what is the current maximum, which again, $1,145.43 per week. Now, when their medical goes stale, there's many other reasons why we can challenge total disability. So let's talk about that. First, their own physician is saying that they're 100% disabled, but often when we depose their treating physician, they back down from that or they change their statement. So they'll say something when I cross-examine them. I'll say, you've been saying for the last 7 years that because of this ankle sprain that occurred in 2018, the claimant can't work. And you keep saying they're totally disabled. They'll say, yep, that's what I wrote in my report. And they'll say, well, what makes them totally disabled? And you'll say, and they'll say something like, well, they had a job as a laborer fixing roofs, and they had to go up and down a ladder, and he complains that his ankle gives way, and so for that reason he can't go up and down that ladder, he's totally disabled. And then my next question is, so you're saying he's totally disabled from the occupation he had or she had at the time of the loss? Oh yes. But they could certainly do other things. Oh yes, they could. Guess what? They're not totally disabled, right? Because the standard for total disability is not totally disabled from your pre-accident line of work. It's any line of work, okay? Any line of work. So when you see things where the doctors are saying that a person is totally disabled for long periods of time, and they're saying disabled, and they'll say words like from prior employment, well, we can challenge that and we can win on that. The other thing is, oftentimes we'll do an investigation, and while we're doing this investigation, we will learn things about the claimant, and this could be obtained either through covert means, meaning surveillance or an investigator, or non-covert means. What's non-covert? Just doing basic investigation like Googling them or looking on their social media and finding all the things that they're claiming they can do or having fun. So you can confront the treating physician with printouts from the person's social media and say, hey, do you realize on Facebook they're saying that they took their kids to Disney World and they went on a vacation. Is that consistent with your finding that they can't use their body part or have a total impairment? And you can use those things to attack or challenge the treating physician's determination of total disability. So that's one opportunity. The other thing you can do to challenge total disability, of course, is to get an independent medical evaluation. And an independent medical evaluator should be looking at this from an impartial standpoint and really do their own opinion, objectively speaking, about whether or not the claimant has a total or less than total disability. If there is a disagreement there, and our physician says, well, I've evaluated the claimant, I've reviewed the medical records, and I've performed a physical examination, and as a result of all of that, I've determined that they are less than totally disabled, guess what? Now you've got an amazing piece of contradictory medical evidence, and you can use that to demand testimony from the treating physician and present the testimony of your impartial or independent medical evaluator and use that to demonstrate to the court as to why the claimant is not totally disabled. And this blows my mind, but this happens relatively frequently in this jurisdiction. The claimant just forgets to go to the doctor, and so more than 90 days has elapsed, and now they haven't seen a physician, and that means that their medical has grown or gone stale, which means we can get a suspension of benefit because they haven't been to the doctor in more than 3 months. So those of us in other jurisdictions where we can tightly control medical, we could see, you know, doctor's appointments are happening once a week. The idea of stretching out those appointments 90 days is crazy. And you'd say, Greg, that's such a low burden. And they're still not going? And the answer is yes, they're still not going. All right, let's talk about our maximum benefit rates. As you can see, each year the maximum benefit rate has been increasing. What is the maximum benefit rate based on? Well, they use something called the state average weekly wage. That's calculated by the state of New York, Department of Banking and Insurance. And what they do is they come up with their calculation for what the average worker in New York is earning. But of course, they exclude all sorts of employments, including governmental employments, from that calculation. And so for that reason, real wages look like they increase very significantly. In some years, they've increased more than 8 or 9%, which we know in reality, that's not true. I mean, wages would double roughly every 7 years if that was accurate. End result is you're going to get this inflated state average weekly wage, which will then be used to calculate the state maximum and the minimums. Now, the minimums just changed due to legislation to increase from the base minimum of $150 a week, which it was for more than 20 years, to this year, as of January 1st, 2024, the state minimum is $275 a week, and we're going to expect that to increase each year. When you're issuing temporary disability, it is based solely on medical impairment. Again, vocational factors are not to be considered by the physician in assessing temporary disability. So the physician should not be saying, well, this person's a laborer who speaks no English, or they're illiterate, or they don't have any computer skills, and therefore this sprained ankle that in every other person in the world, they put a boot on it and go to work and just do whatever. The doctor is not supposed to say, wait a second, but this person, you know, they have low transferability of skills and they don't have much in the way of work experience. And so for that reason, I'm going to find them totally disabled. Absolutely should not do that. And the judge of compensation can't do it either. Okay, so that story where the judge goes, oh, Greg, this person's a laborer and yeah, it's a sprained wrist or a bad ankle, but that's totally disabling them for 3 years because they can't do their laboring job. I have to correct the court, and you should too. Now, we already talked about the waiting period, and I already talked about the fact that there is no limit to how long a claimant can be on temporary disability. For dates of loss after April 10, 2017, there was an amendment to the statute which says that we can argue for a credit against permanent partial disability, loss of wage earning capacity disability, where the temporary disability period exceeded 130 weeks, which if you're doing back of the envelope math, that's 2.5 years. Our argument has to be raised that the claimant has reached maximum medical improvement, and then we can demand the credit. Now, in my experience, and I've been at this for a long time, and we've defended hundreds of cases since April 10, 2017, actually the number is really thousands of them, this is actually very rarely granted because the burden is on us to prove that the claimant had actually reached maximum medical improvement sometime during that temporary total disability period. And that's been very difficult for us to show that because, again, the claimant is receiving temporary total disability. So this has been a difficult loophole in the statute to try to exploit in our experience. We do raise it, of course. Now, you can suspend temporary total disability benefits if the claimant is not working for any of the following reasons. One, they've reached maximum medical improvement, right? Once they've reached maximum medical improvement, statutorily, they're no longer temporarily disabled. If they continue to have a disability that prevents them from working or impairs the function of any of their body's organs, members, or systems, well, that's the definition of a permanent residual impairment, and they would be entitled to permanency compensation, which again will be the subject of a separate presentation. We can argue that benefits should be suspended when they are something less than totally disabled. Anything less than totally disabled, we should argue that benefits should be suspended or reduced. Again, when they have a lack of supporting medical or where the doctor's notes have been delayed. When we can prove that they have voluntarily withdrawn from the labor market, and I'll talk about that in an upcoming slide. And when we can prove that there's the reason they're not earning money is because of something unrelated to the workers' compensation injury, so unrelated wage loss. And that could be for either termination or incarceration. Let's talk about that more specifically, because these are where I get a lot of interesting questions. So when we look at this unrelated wage loss, and we're saying, hey, the person's not working and it's not really because of the injury, there's some other reasons we can look to. If they're not working as a result of the workers' compensation claim, solely, we have to continue benefits, and so we have to continue paying them, okay? But we really have to communicate with each other to figure out why. Now, if the claimant was separated we can argue that they're not entitled to wage replacement, that they were separated for a reason under the claimant's control. And this typically occurs in a circumstance where the claimant has done something to affirmatively break an employer rule or procedure or policy, usually endangering other people, sometimes involving intoxication or drugs, and the employer separates them. We'll make the argument that the reason they're not getting paid money is not just the compensation injury, but also these other things that the claimant themselves did. To prove this, I'm going to need their disciplinary records. If they've resigned, right? That's another unrelated wage loss circumstance. They've resigned from the employment for whatever reason, maybe to accept a retirement or something. I'm going to need the termination documents, and I'm going to need any other reason for their separation or leave. If benefits are already being issued, we're going to want to raise this in front of the court by filing a request for further action. And so that's going to be something that, again, is going to be case by case. But the typical way this plays out is the claimant who has returned to work in some capacity, usually in a light duty capacity or an accommodated work capacity, is working for us and starts violating policies. They stop showing up, so absenteeism. They're chronically tardy, so they're violating a policy, or they're violating a workplace drug or alcohol abuse policy, and they're showing up to work drunk or stoned or high, saying basically, I'm on workers' comp, you can't do anything to me. Well, the answer is you can, and then that separation is unrelated to the workers' compensation claim, and so for that reason, we would challenge their entitlement to ongoing benefits. So you are not a victim if you do try to do the right thing and invite your employees back to work and they misbehave. Okay, you're not stuck. The reason I like to bring this up and talk about it is I often have employers who feel powerless around their employees who have claimed workers' compensation. They want to discipline them for something subsequent, or maybe even discipline them for their own safety violations that resulted in their accident, and feel they can't do anything about it. That's not true. You do have options. All right, so that's the first category, the person who's totally disabled. But what about the less than totally disabled claimant? And that's a pretty big category. This is where they have a temporary disability, but it's not totally disabling. They're able to do some work. They're able to take care of themselves. They're able to handle their activities of daily living. So this is really the majority of claimants. Well, and we're truly talking about a claimant who is less than 100% disabled. And the common terms for this is partial disability or TPD. And you'll see it, and at least to see it more in the medical records, before they switched over to the new forms, where the doctor would say this claimant has a marked temporary disability, and that would mean marked meant 75%. Or they would say this claimant has a mild disability, and that meant 25% disabled. So you could just take those numbers, marked equated to 75%, you could multiply it by the compensation rate, and you could come up with a pretty clear statement as to how much compensation the claimant was due. Again, it's a very simple math formula once you have that percentage of disability. And again, the context we're talking about is where the claimant has less than a 100% disability. Temporary partially disabled claimant has all of the obligations of the totally disabled claimant. Those obligations are to continue to present updated medical documenting that they have this continuing condition. But they also have these other obligations. And they're really important. So I'm going to slow down for a second because I know when you're watching me, the chief complaint I get about these is, Greg, you get excited, you get carried away, and you start talking really fast. So I get that. So I'm going to slow down here for just a second. I just want to talk about the additional obligations that the partially disabled claimant has that the totally disabled claimant does not have these responsibilities or obligations, because these are key. This is where we can really create leverage in these cases. All right. The partially disabled claimant must respond to your light duty offers. They must respond to your light duty offers. They also must look for work within their restrictions if the employer cannot offer them light duty. And look, I've got lots of employers who can't offer their employees light duty, right? It's a busy warehouse. We can't have somebody in a wheelchair wheeling around in here for whatever reason. My mom was a school nurse. She hurt her hand, and they said, look, we don't have light duty for the school nurse position because we don't want to have a partially abled school nurse who's only got one good useful hand what if a kid falls off the monkey bars? It was an elementary school, falls off the monkey bars and it needs CPR, and you only have one hand. You can't really do CPR with one hand. So there's a lot of good reasons why, you know, maybe sometimes an employer can't offer light duty. So where they can't offer light duty, the claimant has the obligation to go out and look for work within their restrictions elsewhere. This requirement that they go out and look for work elsewhere is really the demonstration that they are attached to the labor market, or labor market attachment demonstration. And again, it is not required of a totally disabled claimant. And just like the totally disabled claimant, they cannot voluntarily resign from the labor market, for example, take a voluntary retirement. So now we've got our partially disabled claimant, we know what we can challenge them on, and that informs our tactics. So our tactics are their medical up to date? If the medical is not up to date, you can move to suspend benefits. You can make them a light duty offer to return to employment. And if you've read our lesson book or my handbook, and they're in the today's notes, we offer a lot of good like form letters that you can use to make a light duty offer. Where you've made a valid light duty offer that comports with what their treating physician says the person's restrictions are, and they refuse to accept that light duty offer and come back to the employment, you should suspend benefits. Their case is coming to a close because they are not being cooperative. If we cannot offer them light duty work, they have to go look for work within their restrictions, right? They have to go look for a job someplace else. And do they have to get the job? Nope, but they have to show some activity that they're looking for. We can also investigate if they voluntarily withdrew from the labor market. For example, they did truly intend to retire. Another challenge or tactic in a temporary partial disability case is, are they working someplace else? Are they misrepresenting their actual working ability to their treating physician? Much more common, in my opinion, in the partially temporary disability cases than the total disability cases. And our last tactic, of course, is to obtain contradictory medical. Contradictory medical demonstrating that they have more working ability than they are showing. So when I also talk about this, again, my job here is to create opportunity. I also want to keep in mind our broader goal, which is we do actually want to bring people back to work. We know there are powerful psychosocial factors at play here. And the longer someone's out of work, the less chance they have of returning to any type of gainful employment anywhere. So trying to bring them back to work, trying to have a positive mindset towards our employees, we want to offer that light duty job. If they refuse that light duty job, that is such a strong argument. And the judge should always find in our favor where we can demonstrate that we made a valid work offer and they refused to accept it. Now, what if we can't make that work offer? Again, like my mom's scenario, they didn't want a partially abled primary care provider around for kids in an elementary school. Like my mom was a school nurse, it makes total sense to me. Well, she would have the obligation to go to the labor market and look for a job within her medical restrictions. Now, this sounds onerous, but it really isn't that onerous in practice, because case law has said that looking for a job also includes things that are not really job hunting or really, you know, going on interviews and stuff. It could be something as simple as going to the New York State's Department of Labor's Reemployment Service, or a service offered by the One Stop Career Center, or engaging in some retraining or rehabilitation and signing up for some career counseling. So those items, any one of them, would satisfy the requirement of looking for a job. And in the old days, this used to be, and when I say the old days, I mean pre-COVID, okay? This was a little bit of an onerous thing to tell someone, hey, we can't give you a light duty job. You've been temporarily disabled for a year. You got to go and look for a temporary position within your restrictions. And it seems onerous. And then they realize, wait a second, case law says I can just go to this one-stop career center and register a resume and maybe get one session of career counseling, and that satisfies the requirement. Okay, I'll go do that. But then they have to actually go there in person or at least make a phone call. Now these are apps on their phone. So going to the reemployment center or stopping in at the one-stop career center, those are just apps. So we're really just trying to monitor someone making an appointment over an app and having a virtual career counseling session. Again, this is a very small bar. Like, the bar is very low in this circumstance, but you'd be surprised how many claimants refuse to participate or even attempt. So beyond those sort of alternatives to actual job seeking is the more onerous, which is actually seeking a job that fits their medical restrictions and their skill set. And just to emphasize this point, because I don't want to move on from this without emphasizing it, they don't actually have to get a job. They just have to show that they're looking for a job or looking to get themselves qualified for a job. Okay, that's us raising labor market attachment. And where this is effective, again, is that claimant who's been out of work for 3, 4, 5, 6 years with kind of minimal objective findings. You know, we're talking about the claimant who doesn't really have like a lot of objective issues. You know, there are a lot of pain complaints, a lot of functional restriction complaints, but nothing that's really significant, maybe no surgery cases that have gone on for a long time. This is a great way to get some traction in these cases. So how do you raise it? Well, you simply have to make an argument. We file a request for further action, which is akin to a motion, which states that the claimant's job search has not been timely, diligent, and persistent. And those words come from the case law, which says that the claimant has to have a timely, diligent, and persistent search. And at a minimum, they need to prove the day, month, and year that they contacted someone about getting a job, the name and the address of the employer, what happened with it, the type of job sought, and of course, the response of the potential employer. So that's what they need to show. And because these things are so clear, and set again forward in stat and in the case law, the board has actually issued a very helpful form called the C-258 that the claimant is supposed to use to demonstrate that they have done this diligent work search. In my experience, they rarely voluntarily complete those forms. And it's very important to notice the last requirement that I have up here, the response of the potential employer. If the employer responds to them and says, we're not hiring, that's not a diligent or persistent work search because the place you're applying for jobs isn't actually hiring anyone. So that doesn't count. All right. Now, once you raise these arguments, your adversary is going to say things like, instead of litigating all this, can't we just agree to a tentative rate or a compromised rate? Come on, Greg, we shouldn't have to fight about this. We don't want to have to take testimony. Can't we just agree on some reduced rate? We could all just sort of agree that instead of paying $1,000 a week, you'll pay $500 a week, and we can engage in this sort of compromise. My advice is to never agree to a tentative rate, because once you've done that, you've agreed to a temporary disability rate, A, you've lost the ability to raise that labor market attachment argument, which is one of your strongest arguments in defending your case. And later on, because this is only a tentative agreement, it's not a permanent agreement, later on in the case, when it comes time to settle, your adversary can still say, wait a second, all that time period that we said that it was a tentative rate, they were only 50% disabled. Actually, they were totally disabled, and you owe me more money for that, right? So this can really come back and bite you, and that's why I do not like tentative rates, and I instruct all my attorneys not to ever agree to them. So this leads to litigation on the degree of disability. So how disabled is the claimant? And this slide sort of lays out the path that a typical argument or a typical case would progress when we're litigating the degree of disability. Because remember, the claimant's always going to say, I'm totally disabled. We're going to argue, hey, you're something less than totally disabled. And the reason we argue that is because I want to put the case into the kind of posture where I can raise labor market attachment. So typically, the testificants in a circumstance like this would be the claimant's treating physician, who of course would be trying to defend their opinion that the claimant has a total disability, and generally our independent medical evaluator, who would be of course saying that they have a less than total disability. There's a tremendous amount of litigation in this context. And again, once you raise this as an issue, your adversary is gonna say, can't we just agree? Shouldn't we just be amenable to some type of friendly resolution? And, you know, again, I want you to be very mindful about that. That is a trap that you are being led into. All right, some complicating factors, some factors that sort of make this a little more complicated sometimes. First, where the claimant has been incarcerated after you started paying them wage replacement indemnity benefits. So think about this. They got injured at work. They have some sort of temporary impairment, medical impairment, and now they go to jail for something else. Sometimes it's for selling drugs or getting in a fight or who knows, but now they're in jail. The answer is that you have to continue your temporary disability benefits until they are actually convicted. So somebody sitting in a jailhouse waiting for their trial is actually entitled to temporary disability in this jurisdiction. Another complicating factor is where the employer is paying full wages. Now, sometimes this happens because the employer isn't paying attention and they're just continuing to pay the person. Sometimes it happens because the person is using accrued sick time, or here at Lois Law Firm, we have something called paid sick and safe time. So that's in addition to your vacation days. So these things can happen. Where the employer has continued wages inappropriately or they didn't have to, the workers' compensation carrier would have to reimburse the employer for that two-thirds differential. And I have many clients where there is a unionized environment where the union has negotiated a contract that says something like, we know that the wage replacement benefit in New York is two-thirds of the average weekly wage. However, for the purposes of our unionized employees, the temporary disability rate in a workers' compensation case is going to be agreed upon between these two parties at 85% or 90% of their pre-accident wage. Be especially mindful of those kinds of agreements, because obviously that is extremely incentivizing the employee to stay out of work longer whenever those are tax-free money. So just be mindful about that. Another complicating circumstance can be multiple injuries arising from the same accident. And we kind of see this game of whack-a-mole where first I injured my right shoulder and my left knee, and first it's my right shoulder that's keeping me out of work. And then after my right shoulder heals, now it's my left knee. Now, there should be no overlapping awards for lost time. There is case law that says the opposite, which says that awards for lost time can run concurrently or might not run concurrently, and that you can try to parse these things out. However, I think the best argument is always to say, Judge, how are you going to separate this out? Their shoulder was disabling them. They're not entitled to additional weeks for the other body parts, and this is something that we should fight. So don't fall down on that. Last topic that I'm going to talk about is apportionment. Apportionment exists. Yes, we can apportion current disability to non-work-related injuries. This is a very important and valuable tactic to help you reduce your exposure. Now, a lot of people say, but Greg, how can I do that? So the person got injured at work. We found an ISO that shows the same body part had an injury 10 years ago. Maybe it was from a motor vehicle accident and nothing to do with employment. Maybe it was from a football injury in high school or something. How are you doing that? And the answer is I raise it. I rarely prevail on apportionment, but I raise it. It creates chaos. And when I raise this stuff, I say to my opposing counsel, I say, hey, look, you think you're entitled to 100% disability. I agree the guy has an injury, but he had a pre-existing, and so I shouldn't have to pay on top of that. Now, generally speaking, the judge is not going to agree with that argument, but it will often lead the other side to the negotiation table. So this is something for you to be mindful of and use as an opportunity. This has been litigated, okay, many, many times. And there is case law that says, hey, apportionment to pre-existing conditions is very difficult to prove, but who cares? Again, this is one of those moments where you can raise an argument and get it out there and try to get some traction with it so that you can move the ball towards closing the case. All right, some practical takeaways as I bring this thing home. Number one, most challenges to temporary disability or wage replacement is a tactical challenge. Expect to bring it, maybe to get some short-term relief, but then the claimant to go and try to argue that they should be re-entitled to temporary total disability. When we're litigating this for you, this is nuts and bolts litigation, right? This is standard litigation, usually on degree of disability, sometimes on the appropriateness of the labor market attachment search that the claimant can demonstrate. And what you need there is to have an advocate who's standing in there and yelling, screaming and yelling. I believe that if you are raising these issues, and this is where you're litigating in your case, these are relatively simple issues. And I always believe that a good strategy is one that can be explained in one sentence. I find that when I ask my attorney, hey, what's going on in this case? And they start giving me this long spiel about what happened, what MRI said 5 years. I'm like, well, you're spinning. What is this case really about? What is your closure path? What is your tactical action? Give this to me in a sentence. Tell me what you're doing. And if the answer isn't looking you in the eyes and saying, Greg, I am raising labor market attachment in this case because there is a work capacity here and this claimant is not going to be able to demonstrate those proofs. I'm like, okay, I got it. You have a plan. You understand what it is. It's relatively simple and you're able to pursue it. So that's what I really want to hear. Our joke here at Lois Law Firm is that your case strategy should fit on a matchbook. That's how short it's to be and succinct and clean and clear. The last thing I'll say is we need to use some common sense though when we're considering litigating some of these issues. Like, is it worth it? Particularly where the claimant is has a low average weekly wage, so they might be a low wage earner, and there might not be a tremendous amount of value to litigating these things. Or the claim is expected to reach maximum medical improvement naturally, so we might not have to have such a huge fight about it. All right, we are ready to move into questions and answers, and this is my favorite part, so I'm hoping that everyone paid attention the two times I mentioned this already earlier, and said, what are your questions? So let me open up the question panel. Oh, good, there's questions in here. Oh, thank goodness. You guys are making my day. Wait a second, this is all one person? Hold on a second, let's see. All right, no, we got a whole bunch. Okay, good. All right, Brad asked the first question at 12:30. He said, Greg, based on temporary total disability standard you outlined, couldn't one reasonably conclude that there are extremely limited cases where one could be considered temporary total disability? Yes, that's right, because we're not talking about same employment disability, right? That's not what we're talking about. We're saying, could you do anything? And when you really think about it, I mean, couldn't anybody, you know, pick up the phone and make some calls? I have employers who offer light duty. That is as simple as you're just going to sit in the warehouse, you're going to count the trucks going in and out. We're going to call it loss prevention. Really, I just want to keep you here, and I want to keep you on the payroll, and I want to keep you engaged for psychosocial purposes. And that's fine, right? And when I confront the treating physician, I go, here's the job we have for him. He's going to be sitting there in our loss control booth. He's going to watch trucks come in and out of the hub all day, and he's going to count the trucks coming in and trucks going out. That's his job. No treating doctor in the world is going to say, oh, he can't do that with a bum ankle. Of course he can. Of course he can. So the answer is yes, Brad. These are very challengeable cases. So I'm glad that came through. All right. Chelsea, who asked a bunch of questions, here's her first one from 12:32, says, Greg, regarding maximum medical improvement in a continuing carrier payment scenario, so if an active carrier continued payment case, when the C-4.3, that's a short term that means permanency evaluation, finds maximum medical improvement and opines a scheduled loss of use, carrier should immediately file an RFA-2 for suspension? Yeah, absolutely. Right? Absolutely. Well, they're MMI now. You've got a C-4.3. That, by definition, there shouldn't be a permanency finding on there unless they've reached maximum medical improvement. So, good. All right, you're in good shape. Next, Julia. Greg, could you talk about the waiting period in terms of days? Does the waiting period include Monday to Friday only, or when does the waiting period include weekends? Okay, it's calendar days. It's calendar days. So it's not 7 working days that they have to miss. It's just 7 calendar days from the date of the loss to the date they first come back. Okay, calendar days. Whether or not they were only scheduled to work 3 of those days or 5 of those days or 6 or 1 or 2, I don't care. We're looking at calendar days. That's how we're going to calculate that. Okay, Peggy, Greg, I've heard this argument that temporary partial disability claimant doesn't have to work while they're still employed by the insured. Yeah, I know. I've heard that many times too. Not correct. It's raised in court all the time. I've even had judges tell me that. I've even had judges say, well, Greg, you know, you guys, you didn't fire him, so technically he still has a job with you, so you can't make him go look for a job somewhere else. I'm like, well, the case law says, why don't you put that in your decision so I can appeal you and I'll make more case law on it, right? That's wrong. That's just wrong. I'll take it even a step further. My partner, Toshia, had a case, or might have been my partner, no, I don't remember which one had this case, where the claimant was a member of the union and got injured on a construction site. And the union had all sorts of rules, like, my unionized employees, they only take certain kinds of jobs and whatever. And so we raise labor market attachment, say, hey, they're not looking for a job. They're temporarily partially disabled. Their own doctor conceded that. And they're not looking for a job within their restrictions. And the claimants counsel came into court, waived the union contract, and goes, union contract says, blah, blah, blah. I go, okay, that's not correct. They're, I don't care what their contractual status is. That's not what the statute says. Statute says everyone has to look for a job within their restrictions. Guess what? The board panel agreed with us of the appellate division. So those arguments do not fly. All right, they do not fly. All right, I hope that answers your question, Peggy. Now, Elizabeth, something like that. Okay. Can an injured worker that had a 2023 knee claim, retired in February 2024, now waiting for the knee surgery, be entitled to a scheduled loss of view if they retired before having the surgery? Yeah, because that's permanent residual impairment. They don't get temporary disability while they're waiting for that scheduled knee to undergo, but they can still get a permanent residual disability impairment award. So that is possible. All right, last question I'm gonna have. Well, I might have time for two more. Chelsea says, Greg, regarding voluntary payments, I know initially payments need to be made with or without medical, but for how long? Should carrier voluntarily pay without a formal CCP direction forever, assuming medical supports? Would you still consider a DOD opinion? I don't know what DOD stands for. DOD opinion, good for 90 days if payments are voluntary. If claimant is consistently producing temporary total medical, is there any reason to stop voluntary payments? Would best practice be to schedule an IME for contrary opinion? Okay, so the answer to that is gonna be yes. So let me just walk that through. Chelsea said, I've got a case that is an admitted accepted loss. The person got injured, started going to the doctor. Doctor puts them out temp total. We don't challenge it. We just start paying them temp total. Which, by the way, you did the right thing. Okay, that's what you should be doing. Good job. But at some point, you start realizing, wait a second, this is getting abusive. They're never going to max med this person, and you go get your IME. Once you get that IME and you have challenging contradictory medical, remember, you're not under an order to pay. You can just stop or start paying consistent with your IME. You've now taken back control of your case. You're doing the right thing. So that would be my advice in that one. Here we go. Can you credit temporary TR periods in a 130-week clawback rule case? This is also from Chelsea. No, right? Because they're not temporary total disability. You'd have to stipulate first that they are temporary total disability weeks, okay? And then pay them at that rate, and then you could credit them, right? That's how that would work. All right. Denise. Greg, is there a penalty for issuing a late payment? Yes, 20% typically would be the appropriate late payment. Not the first payment, but a follow-up payment. Yeah, any payment could have a 20% penalty attached to it. So, all right, good questions. I'm glad I got so many questions. That's all of them. It's also time for me to start my next webinar, which is on New Jersey workers' compensation. So let me run. I got 2 minutes to spare. Thanks for joining us. Now, before you leave, just know this. There's lots of ways to learn here at Lois. Number one, check out our newsletter. If you haven't subscribed to it, please do. You can get that on our website. We have a whole bunch of podcasts. I also always pitch my partner Christian's podcast. It's called Third Fridays, and it's released, not surprisingly, on the third Friday of the month, and it's about interesting issues in workers' comp. So thanks for joining us today. I hope everybody has a great day, and I will see you next time.